Thanks, Dr. Key. And welcome to the hardcore that's still here. If any of you have to leave because what I'm saying makes you uncomfortable or because you've got a plane to catch, I won't take it personally. But this is kind of a special opportunity to speak because I don't really have to cover any data. I'll throw a little bit in just for, you know, credibility's sake. But I'd like to respond kind of to the spirit and energy of the last few days that we've all been experiencing. You know, somebody happened to be riding the elevator with me this morning, and a quick exchange determined that we might both end up in the same session. And she asked me, "Oh, what are you talking about?" And I thought for a second, I said, "Revolution." actually, this is somewhat of a recycled talk from an invited discussion I gave a week or two ago. I was asked to talk about Title V, which is celebrated its 75th anniversary, and I agreed and then rapidly went to Google to find out what Title V was. And I found this interesting description that basically presents the Title V program as something that was enacted by FDR. Is there a way to advance these slides from? Oh, left click. Okay, thanks. They said that federal programs were being cut, women and children were having worse health in the Depression years, and Roosevelt gave us Title V. And further searching around on the HRSA website produced this MCH timeline, a number of interesting things about Child Health Day and the initiation in 1938 of the March of Dimes, milk fortification to prevent rickets, and Title V. But they left a lot of things out of the timeline. And I found another interesting blurb on a Library of Congress website where they said something more about the social and political and historical determinants of that period. They noted that it was difficult for many to understand why people should go hungry in a country possessing huge food surpluses. Blaming Wall Street speculators, bankers, and the Hoover administration, you can replace Hoover with whoever the president happens to be. The rumblings of discontent grew mightily in the early 1930s. By 1932, hunger marches and small riots were common throughout the nation. And this did remind me of other things on the 1930s timeline, besides medicine and epidemiology. I'm sort of interested in history, and I think it's very important for us all to become more knowledgeable about history if we want to have some impact on the way the history of our current period unfolds. During the 1930s, the previous Great Depression, there were millions of people on the street, and maybe even more influential, over 5 million industrial workers in key industries such as auto and steel were organized into the CIO unions, many of them organized by Communist Party organizers, such as those that led the Flint sit-down strike in 1937. There was at that time one country in the world that did not have unemployment. Unemployment was terrible, rampant throughout Europe and the Americas, but there was one country which no longer exists, which had zero unemployment rate. There were laid off auto workers from Detroit that were going to Moscow to get jobs because they were hiring. There were also things going on in the United States that would be probably among the most historic struggles against racism of the 20th century, such as the anti-lynching campaign and the defense of the Scottsboro defendants in Alabama. And it was in this context that a lot of social legislation, including Title V, but also Social Security and unemployment insurance and other things came into existence. So if I were going to rewrite the paragraph about where did Title V come from, I wouldn't just say FDR. He was pushed by mass multiracial movements that were going on in the streets and in the factories, new forms of unionism that were much more militant, and basically a mass movement that threatened the status quo, so that when he went to the people who financed his political campaign, he could say to them, I think we'd better give in on this one. We don't seem to have those pressures right now. More recent history, also related to periods of social change in the 1960s, include mass movements that we're familiar with. However, even as we collected some of the fruits of those movements in the 1970s with increased employment opportunities and political opportunities, especially for people of color, by the 1980s, this trend had been reversed. Racist unemployment was having a huge upsurge, and home foreclosures were happening even then, and that's only gotten worse. So, with this sort of historical context, let's talk about infant mortality, since that's what I'm actually supposed to know something about. As has already been pointed out, and as you all know, there are glaring racial disparities in this country, and that it is higher, as are all mortality or health adverse results, higher in this country than in other countries of similar wealth. But what is not talked so much about is that not only are we not improving or closing the gaps, we're actually getting worse. And the other detail that's often omitted is that infant mortality for white infants is quite high. I was pleased to hear Dr. David Williams point out in a talk he gave yesterday or the day before, absolutely identical sort of data when he looked at population-wide indicators using multiple outcomes such as life expectancy. The United States ranks very poorly, and the United States whites rank very poorly internationally, even if you leave minorities out of the picture. A little more about the black-white gap. You can look at birth outcomes by birth weight, low birth weight, very low birth weight, infant mortality. There's always a 2 to 3-fold worse result for the African Americans. And here's just the basic stats on the widening gap. Relative risk was 1.6 in mid-century, and by the end of the 20th century, 2.3. And it's higher than that now, 2.4 something, I think. This is the reason. I don't think I need to belabor this point in this setting. People have moved beyond race as the biological construct and understand that are the social forces that give rise to the type of stresses that Dr. Braverman was describing for us are key. There are many forms of it. I'm not going to go through all of them, but you're all familiar with these. And that slide could actually be made even more illegible. I could put 20 more things on there, and they would all be true and well-proved through the sociological literature. The impact is, again, as Dr. Braverman's already explained to us, through probably the most plausible mechanism being talked about now is stress, and it's mediated through the HPA axis of our chronic influence over time. Allostatic load is another term that's used for this type of dysregulation of the arousal mechanisms over many, many years. A more difficult question is, since we understand this, why doesn't it go away? Why are the gaps widening instead of narrowing? And the cultural explanation, you know, these guys are about to be misprogrammed, just like Rodgers and Hammerstein explained, you know, a few decades ago. But there's more to it than just passing on bad ideas within families or within communities. And I would like to present something different, which I'm calling the political economy of racism. If you just do some simple calculations, working age population, 129 million whites, 19 million African Americans, and then you look at the income ratio for whites and African Americans, and you see that it's stable, or maybe deteriorating slightly or improving slightly, but basically it's stable at about 2/3. That is to say, an African American doing a job gets paid about 2/3 what a white person doing a job gets. If you multiply the 19 million African Americans times $14,481 per year, which is that fraction of their income, you come out with $275 billion per year money saved by employers using racial differentials in wages. Now, once you get up in the, you know, $200 to $300 billion a year range, we're starting to talk about some serious money here. And this obviously can buy a lot of airtime. This can decide, make production decisions on a lot of mass media, and so forth. And I'm saying that there is something built into the racial disparity in opportunity that is very profitable for some people. This, I think, leads to what we're all familiar with, sort of continuing racist miseducation, whether it's in our schools, in subtle decisions and behaviors of our employers, in the TV news, anything in mass culture, leading to the racial tension which we're all so familiar with. I would submit to you that racism is one of the fundamental mechanisms that stabilizes a social system that, in my opinion, is overdue for upheaval. Now, let me come back to this question of white infant mortality. If you compare infant mortality rates in the best performing nations or communities in the world, Hong Kong, I think, led the list in 2005, where I got these data, with 2.3 infant deaths per 1,000 live births, giving them the first rank internationally. United States, the entire population, ranked 29th that year. But the less known fact is that U.S. white infants, if you rank them as a separate country, would have been 24th. And this is not to say that it's not worse for African Americans, who would have been 52nd. But the point is that it's not like there's a great advantage to being white compared to the rest of the world. So we have to move on to the other health disparity, and Dr. Braidman's work has been excellent in terms of fleshing out this general concept, but I'm going to try to extend the political economy argument to deal with that as well. First, just the basic calculations, and again, this is relative to the related to the fact that the population of European Americans is much larger than the population of African Americans. But if you just take the excess deaths that are caused by having infant death rates higher than Hong Kong in 2005, that led to about 6,500 excess deaths for African Americans, and in the same year, to over 8,000 excess deaths for whites in this country. Class, as was mentioned earlier, is almost talked about like it, well, it's not talked about, basically. It's well, when we first started doing articles about racism, Diane Rowley and her co-workers at the CDC, who were brave enough and thought, you know, creative enough to bring together people to start having this conversation 15 years ago or whenever it was, they used to jokingly refer to the R word because it wasn't really acceptable in a scientific meeting to use the word racism. So now I'm going to introduce the C word, well, maybe a few C words, but let's start with class. Most white people in the United States are not, in fact, presidents and members of boards of directors. But government policy, arguably, is very pro-corporate in the United States. That's not such a hard case to make, especially after the last welfare reform is that nobody that's not a billionaire can get welfare. But anyway, but the statistics are that about 1% of U.S. population owns most of the stock, and that gives them a lot of decision-making power, not only economically, but also politically. Now, what does this do to health? Marmot and many others, the Whitehall studies are maybe the most famous example of doing this, but now beautifully reproduced in some of the work that Dr. Braidman already shared with us in this session. But just using the classic Whitehall studies, when you looked at British civil servants, and in Britain they are very meticulous about recording social class on their health data rather than just race, they were able to show that civil servants, broken out into six different grades, have quite a steep gradient of mortality, and the relative risks that we're talking about, two to threefold in various things, for example, coronary heart disease. The key feature that seems to be the risk-bearing or risk mechanism component is job strain, which means jobs that require a lot of you but give you no control. So if you're the guy sorting mail down in the mail room and you've got as many cases of mail to sort as they bring to you, you have no control over that, and you can't leave until it's all done, you would have a job which is characterized by high demand and low control. Whereas if you're the assistant to the secretary, several notches up the Whitehall scale, you would have a much different life at work. How does job strain affect women on the job? Well, in a way that's very similar to the way racism impacts on people. Whether it's petty hassles, insults, or powerlessness, the social injustice that's captured by all of these things is absorbed by the body. If you want data, the folks in Quebec, dealing with a mostly white population who all have health insurance, showed that there is a 2.7 times increase in preterm birth in women that have high job strain in their study. So working women in the United States currently have the highest rate of job force participation in history and have longer working hours than women in any other industrialized nation. These facts may be related to some of the health outcomes we're seeing. And again, to look at the trends over time, your position in the pecking order, or how the Whitehall equivalent shapes up now versus in some years past, is reflected in the income differences. Income changes between 1979 and 2005, basically it was the top 1% that had the big increases, and everybody else lagged behind. So why doesn't this go away? Well, here we get to the other political economy. If you assume that a workforce that is divided along racial, ethnic, gender, whatever, identity politics kind of lines, you want to divide them, they're divided in such a way that they cannot negotiate effectively against the employer's demands for lower wages, cuts in their health insurance, et cetera, then the net effect population-wide is going to be a depression of wages for all of the employed. And if you look at white wages and just assume a modest 10% reduction in income that would be accomplished, say, by that divide and conquer technique, multiplied by the 129 million white employees, now we're talking about over $500 billion in annual savings. So this is another big chunk of money that is out there to pay for advertising or purchasing universities or whatever else you might want to spend it on, that can be expected to influence our thinking. What's to be done? Well, I was presenting this actually before the election and caused a little trouble. But what I said is in Illinois, our taxes will pay for about $1.8 billion worth of military expenditures for Iraq and Afghanistan for the next fiscal year. Or they could go for nearly a million children getting health insurance. And what I said then, and I'll say again now, is as soon as they put this on the ballot, I'm going to start voting. My critique is that U.S. democracy is not popular. It's corporate. And if it was corporate before, it's even more so now. The amount of money that's pouring into the elections is just scandalous. As Robert Reich put it, anyone who doubts the corrupting effect has not been paying attention. Our elected official representatives have been acutely sensitive to the needs of Wall Street. So I would suggest that the corporate model of democracy, that is where the biggest shareholders basically choose the board and the board must fill its responsibility, which are profits, that's the kind of democracy that we seem to have here. I said before that racism is a strut that's holding up a system of inequality. Just another quick flashback on history is that I think racism plays a unique role in the society that we live in. It needs to be overcome, and the truth about class in the United States and understanding that truth and disseminating that truth is one of the steps to overcoming it. We need to make sure everybody understands that blacks, whites, and everyone else are mostly people working for a living, that government policy is pro-corporate, and besides that 1% that owns most of the stock, the other 99% of us are more alike than we are different, and that should drive our politics. So we need to oppose racism not as some type of a charitable activity that, you know, those of us who happen to not be members of identified minority groups, I can pass for white even though my half of my family comes from Syria. But anyway, those of us who are not in an identified minority group need to link arms with our brothers and sisters who are in such groups, not out of charity, but out of solidarity. We need this so we can all move forward and we can deal with the class question. The other C word I might mention has to do with Nancy Krieger's observation that we are getting very good at sketching out the web of causation in terms of the social determinants of health. But we're all so reluctant to name the spider. And I would submit to you that capitalism, that social system which demands inequality, is at the basis of a lot of our problems. Anti-racist activism in the 30s and the 60s leads the way. It has to be anti-racist to be effective. So what do we do? This is always the hardest part. I don't have any ready solutions. Nothing easy. But there were mass movements in the 30s. We need to have mass movements again. And those need to be multiracial in nature. They have to focus on the big problems. We've been through all these days of APHA. Not much has been said about the trillions of dollars that are going off to foreign wars instead of taking care of the health problems that are causing problems in our cities. And the government has to be forced, in a word, to serve the people. And this can happen right here in APHA. We actually had protests. Those with good eyes can actually spot at least one prominent MCH person marching around the exhibit hall a couple of years ago, demanding that the military recruiters be removed from our conference. And the following year, we had a nice march with some community activists in the HIV/AIDS campaign in Washington, D.C. These things require, as well as local protests in my community, these types of activities require us to step out of the roles that we're comfortable in. I mean, I'm much more comfortable standing up here with a PowerPoint than I am walking around with a sign. But we have to do that. If we want to build good health through social justice, being a good health professional is not enough. We have to step out of our assigned role. We have to have the intellectual courage to ask all the questions and even say the words that are forbidden words, like the C word. We have to fight for core values, if that's what we believe in. And they will call us names. As the liberation theologian said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. So I would say, you know, if I can make a parting shot for all of us as we head back home, our job is not just to fine-tune, you know, the various things and the programs we work on, which are all very important and wonderful, and, you know, we have to do it, but we really have to change the world. Thank you. Well, I would say that the only way there can be any kind of positive social change is by fighting against racism. I don't think that's enough, but I think it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for moving things forward. And I think the importance of understanding the political economy of racism is that it makes it obvious that there is, you know, a need for everybody to do that. So it shouldn't be race, you know, doesn't exist biologically, but it sure as hell exists in the form of racism. And everyone needs to be aware of that, and we need to teach the people that we can teach and, you know, organize the people we can organize.
And I really would be remiss if I don't add something to that. The thing, we are in Office of Minority Health. If I had a dollar for every time we have received a call saying, well, and where is the Office of Minority Health? And it's the sense of this is some privilege that minorities are receiving that supposedly the rest of the population, and mind you, since we include minorities, the rest of the population we are talking about, obviously, the white population. And again, as both of the speakers said, class is a big problem, and again, certainly not all whites are CEOs. But I think the idea and the ideal of a world post-racial and all of that is great, and it's a beautiful ideal, but race is not the it's not by you not noticing that I have an accent and that I am black that you are doing something good for me. That's not the problem. It's that you notice my difference, that doesn't, it's that you diminish me because of my difference. That's where the problem lies. So we believe, certainly, that race shouldn't matter, but it does. And until we make it not to matter, we do have to take it into account. And that's something that goes beyond, I mean, yes, it matters because it affects us. And I always say race is the most powerful non-existent thing that there is. I mean, it's extreme, it's non-existent, but boy, is it powerful.
And I want to add just one more comment to those excellent comments. I think that strategically for us, focusing politically on institutional racism is a very promising direction to go in. And so that policies that would selectively, disproportionately favor the groups who have been most disadvantaged, policies in communities, disadvantaged communities, because that's one where you don't even have to talk about, you know, who's being racist, who's not being racist, intent, but you get at something that so fundamentally determines the power, the resources and power of the next generation of people.
Well, I'm Linda Green. I'm from the Metropolitan Washington Public Health Association, a self-identified communist. But the thing about the next year's meeting is that we'll be in Washington, D.C., and our affiliate would like to do better than we did the last time we came and have a bigger march or a bigger multiracial protest around things. So if people have suggestions, the affiliate is very interested in figuring out how to advance this struggle. I do want to emphasize the one thing that we've tried to do in D.C., and that is to build multiracial unity. This is a very difficult project in terms of fighting back, but it's the best way to build multiracial unity. If you join together in a struggle, then you really trust each other and you really begin to fight around important issues. In RFA/AIDS work, this has been very important. I also think that one thing I was thinking about when you were speaking about all the stuff at the beginning in California and so forth is that a lot of the research projects and things that are done lend themselves to activism. And if there's a component of that built into some of our work, whether it's community-based participatory research or some of the services that we provide, we can unite with more of our to the people that we're serving in a sense and do something active, whether it's going to the city council or protest or something. We build those ties for multiracial unity. And I think that has to be very conscious. And I think if we do that, we'll build much more unity and overcome some of the segregation that's in society. Because it is really a difficult project, but it's very valuable when it happens. So help us out in D.C. next year. Thank you.
I'm not going to be able to give you any data. The question was the racial disparities in American Indians and infant mortality. That work, I believe, has been done. There are a number of health outcomes, and I think infant mortality is one of them that is disparate. But it's important to recognize, even though each of these ethnic minorities is distinct and different, the hierarchy of health outcomes, to me, seems to be roughly on a gradient that has to do with the history that we've experienced. So it's not an accident that the, you know, no class politics of the culture we live in happens, and in a way it's different from what you see in Europe and most other parts of the world. This is also the only modern industrialized country that was built on the extermination of one ethnic group and the enslavement of another. And those two ethnic groups, because of that specific history, are going to be the ones we would expect to have, you know, the most disadvantaged outcomes. You know, we also, you know, stole half the country from Spanish-speaking people that had a country already, okay? And that has its effects as well. And these are distinctly different from someone who is, say, of Japanese ethnicity, also an ethnic group, which has been subjected to some pretty ugly stuff at different times, but it's not been as prolonged, protracted, and deadly as either the American Indians or African Americans.
And I do have... On the good news column, we are actually working in the Office of Minority Health. We are actually working right now. Just the money is in. We are working in a project to develop a program. We are doing the formative research right now. All of the program that I described with the African American community, well, that's the one that we are more. I mean, that we serve first. It's strategic, it's the money, it's et cetera. So obviously we cannot tackle them all at once, but then we are now working the money's in, and we are doing the formative research actually on a project for the Native American community. And yes, the infant mortality rate is just staggering.
Obviously, we have to be strategic, and I do think that, you know, although there's not a lot of NIH support for documenting social inequalities in health, that's still a very important activity, and they need to be monitored over time. Getting that out to people and organizing with it is very important. I think that the advancing the agenda on the mechanisms through which racial inequalities, socioeconomic inequalities lead to poor health outcomes. I used to feel that was a bit of a diversion in some way, but what I've seen is that being able to argue for the biological plausibility for the linkage between the underlying inequality and the inequality in health outcomes has been very important. So I think that there's a lot of room, and there's no one area. I think most important is that you raise that question. And when you think of what you have to offer, what are your skills, what do you know something about, and you think about what's happening in the relevant field, and you ask yourself the question, can I identify a missing piece of information which, if my research agenda contributed to that, actually might make a contribution? So I think you can't go wrong as long as you keep asking that question.
Director for the Center for Disease.
actually, I'm hoping that Isabel will address this because I think you've really been thinking about the strategy, but I want to take advantage of that question because it touches on something that I mentioned before. Do you know that the relative disparity in preterm birth and in low birth weight, the relative black-white disparity is highest among the educated, more affluent women. It's smaller among the poor women. That's, you know, one of the clues to us that this is not, you know, we're not dealing with something that's, you know, that's primarily genetic. You know, in addition to that, the fact that Africans, that immigrants, and actually Dick has done some of the best research on this, black immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean actually have relatively favorable birth outcomes that are more like those of European Americans. So, but in terms of the strategy of getting that message out there, you've been thinking about that a lot.
And basically that's why we are doing the program, because the issue is the translation problem is what remains. Clearly, I'm sure your sister, and I cannot tell you how sorry I am, but I'm sure your sister had a doctor, etc. But still, the provider factor is a factor. But also, at the end, there is information that has to be drilled down, way down. And that's, I guess, our answer to that is our program. We are working to expand it, to bring it to the youngest, to bring the youngest, to bring it to their houses. It's an awareness issue. There is the medical part of it, and there is the awareness part of it, and there is, at the end of the day, this is not about the medical piece is important, but this is not about the medical piece. This is about how people are living, and because what we want the NICU to be there and everything, but we would love to have it empty. We would love to have no one at the NICU, and no one being born early, and certainly no baby to die. So the point is to improve how we are living.